Welcome to the 12th episode of Extra Sequential. It would have worked out well if we did our horror special, perhaps our 13th episode, but we can't really bring Halloween back a week.
If we could turn back time, perhaps our life would become a horrible tale. My name's Mladen Lukatin, and the voice you heard just before me is Chris Murders Women in the Bather. See what I did there?
Well, I was just having flashbacks of a middle-aged woman in fishnets straddling a cannon on a Navy battleship.
A previous life, maybe, Chris.
The Sure song?
I know.
Yeah. Just to explain my weird shenanigans.
And that fits into our horror theme. A horrifying horror image theme? Ties into our horror theme for today's very special show. We'll be talking about the history of horror comics in America and Japan, and mentioning some of our favorite, maybe unknown titles, and some recommendations for you, and also the new books that are out that we think you should check out. That about sums it up, I reckon.
Yeah, very well. Have we said the name of our podcast yet?
I guess not. What
Extra
was it again?
Sequential.
That's it.
So we talk about comic books, pop culture-y kind of general stuff, superheroes, mm-hmm. manga, the weird, the fascinating, the stuff you are reading, the stuff you should be reading, the stuff you should avoid.
Wow. And don't forget independent comics. I think we missed those because we cover a lot of independent comics.
We do.
Yeah, more so than others, I'd say.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
So, yes, we thought we would celebrate Halloween, so this week is our horror special. But before we get into that, it's time for the news.
First news item, Chris made me aware of this one. They're making another Asterix animated film, but this time it's in 3D, the third dimension.
Oh, boy. I don't know how I feel about 3D, but it's good that the French are getting on board with it.
They've been making a lot of fairly good Asterix animated films. The live-action ones I didn't care for, the Gérard Depardieu ones. This one they're making is based on Asterix and the Mansions of the Gods, which I think I may have lent to you.
Yeah, that was the one I read. Is that the one where they go to Egypt and the slaves and all that?
I also lent you that one. This one is when the Romans decide to sort of Romanize the Gauls by putting like a Roman apartment complex right next to their village.
Oh, yes.
So all these like wealthy yuppie Romans basically move in and they ruin the economy of the town by like buying their fish, and they keep raising the prices, and you know, everyone sort of loses what made them them. You know,
that's an interesting one to make into a 3D film.
It's
not the most adventurous pact of the Asterix films.
Yeah, there's only a few sort of actiony bits, like when they're clearing the forest and they're ripping out the trees, and they're just sort of pulling them up by hand. Because they have those strong secret powers and that.
Magic potions.
Yeah, I probably won't see it, to be honest. There's been so many of these.
Yeah.
But 3D
is an animated 3D. It's not live-action 3D.
And speaking of animated 3D, let's see. Yeah, Pluto. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, when you first mentioned it, I thought you meant the dog, Mickey Mouse's dog.
Yeah, everyone says that.
It sounds vaguely familiar. Yeah, it's a manga type.
It's the manga by Naoki Urasawa, who did 20th Century Boys.
Okay.
Yeah, Pluto is a dark, complex murder mystery story, and it's set in the world of Astro Boy, so it's kind of a spin-off.
Oh, okay.
But it's quite sort of dark. The early Astro Boy stories were quite dark in parts, so it sort of plays off that a bit. There's a guy, something's going around murdering the robots, but, you know, the robots all have human emotions, so it's quite sort of scary, and because they can get away ripping arms off and stuff with robots, it's quite unpleasant. But it's being produced by Universal and Illumination. Illumination are a new company. They just did Despicable Me, which went gangbusters.
Oh, okay.
So it's not being done by Imagi, you know, the company which bankrupted themselves doing that most recent Astro Boy movie.
Oh, did they? They did the Ninja Turtles as well, didn't they?
Yeah, it's kind of a shame, isn't it? Because I quite liked that Ninja Turtles movie.
Yeah, it was cool.
Mm.
So, well, is there like same characters that appear in Pluto and Astro Boy?
Astro Boy does appear in it. He never, I don't think he puts on the outfit. He's just like this weird little kid, basically, which is interesting. Like, he's just this bizarre child. And this is the point in the story where I think he was being sort of mistreated and stuff. So it's interesting. But they're saying it's, the info on it says live action slash CGI. So I'm quite curious whether it'll be live action actors plus CGI robots, which could be fun. But recently there was a series of Japanese films based on 20th Century Boys, and they were really successful in Japan. So I think they're sort of trying to keep that ball rolling. And if this film does well, I mean, the worst that could happen is Naoki Urasawa's work, you know, finds more of an audience in the West. So I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Did you hear someone laughing in the background?
Did you say something really funny that went over my head? Or
no, just someone else in the apartment's giggling like crazy.
Your girlfriend just has bouts, fits of laughter, which I can entirely understand. If I was dating you, I'd probably have the same response. But okay, so this,
laughing with me, not at me. Jeez. I'll just quickly. I mentioned there's been a new graphic novel awards set up by yes. the Penn State University and the Daughters of Lind Ward, which we mentioned Lind Ward on our Wordless Graphic Novels podcast.
Yes. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. Setting up just the Lind Ward Prize, and every year they'll give $2,500 for the best graphic novel in fiction or nonfiction published that year. The selection panels all kind of Penn State University academics and stuff who use graphic novels in their teaching and research, as well as some alumni who work in graphic novels and stuff from the university. So I'm guessing it's a little bit niche-y, actually, considering it's all from that university. But yeah, kudos to them. And I like that graphic novels are getting university recognition.
Yeah, it's been happening a lot more, especially in America, which is good. I guess it happens in Europe as well, but we don't really hear about it as much here.
No, that's for sure, yeah. I wish we did, actually. That'd be good.
Yeah.
One you brought to my attention, the that anime stage show.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sure you know as much as I do about this. It sounds terrible. Well, it's touring throughout France, Belgium, Germany, and Italy, and it's a pop opera starring Japanese actors. Supported by star musicians such as singer Pico and game musician Daisuke Asukara.
Okay.
Asakura, sorry.
So what's it called?
Japan Anime Live! With an exclamation mark. Yeah. And it's based on material from Naruto, One Piece, Bleach, Full Metal Alchemist, and the Gundam series. So the last one's probably the only one I'm interested in, to be honest.
So all these characters will appear side by side and do the can-can, or...?
Something like that. The videos I've seen look basically like, you know what cosplayers are, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Looks like cosplayers jumping around and smacking each other with swords and singing a bit.
Wow.
So if you have no taste, you should totally go to the shows in Paris, Brussels, Dusseldorf, Mila, Florence, and Rome.
I suppose it's one for the kids.
Yeah, for sure. That's, oh, yeah.
They see Naruto on TV and think, hey, they're fighting. He's an awesome fighter. I wonder how he sings.
I wonder what this came, like, what sparked this? Who thought this? Yeah. Maybe that, like, they knew about the Spider-Man musical being worked up.
Yeah.
Because Avatar, the Last Airbender movie just came out.
Yeah.
Not the other more famous Avatar film.
I've never heard of that one. I don't know what you're talking about.
No.
Yeah. I guess it's maybe the Ministry of Arts in Japan thought they'd get out some of their most popular characters.
Oh, boy. Kind of crazy.
Into the world.
And I'm so glad you told me about this next piece of news.
John is dead.
John dies at the end.
That's the one.
That's the name of the novel by David Wong. It was initially just released free online. It's still up there for free online, and he's also selling printed copies. So
it's a novel? It's like a black humour kind of book?
Yeah, it's a novel, kind of a horror comedy with lots of...
Okay.
He describes it as like a horror story with fart jokes, which I think is a bit unkind, but it's really quite hilarious. There's this sort of drug going around called soy sauce, which sort of connects people to the supernatural realm, I think. It's been so long since I've read it, but I remember like just giggling like a crazy man.
Like but your friend earlier.
Yeah, that's right. A dude called Don Cascarelli. Coscarelli? I've not heard of him before. But he's adapting the book into a feature film. But the cool bit is the casting information. Paul Giamatti.
Yes, from Sideways.
Mm-hmm. Sideways.
And Shoot 'Em Up. Shoot 'Em Up is an awesome movie. Have you seen that?
No, I have not. Oh, wait. No, yes, I have. I've seen...
Clive Owen and Monica Bellucci in it.
I watched like 2/3 of it and then got kind of... I sort of felt like I got the gist of it and gave up.
Yeah.
But Paul Giamatti was also in the American Splendor movie?
Yes.
Which was really good. I don't know if you've seen it. Yeah. So he has a bit of a comic cred. And also Clancy Brown of...
Highlander. He was in Highlander 2.
Highlander and Carnivale. He was the counterpoint to Nick Stahl's character. He was like an evil priest, basically. The priest had nothing to do with him being evil, but yeah.
There's also Clancy Brown is also the voice of Lex Luthor in the...
Did not know that.
all the recent Superman and Justice League animated cartoons.
Mm. And Paul Giamatti and Clancy Brown will be starring together in the upcoming Goon adaptation.
They will, which I will talk about later. Yeah, there's a Goon CGI film produced by David Fincher. So yeah. I don't know when that's coming out, but the trailer looks pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited in the the Goon project and John Dies at the End. I wasn't too keen before, but now I'm like, wow, these show a lot of promise.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, comic fans be happy.
That's some pretty good news there, eh?
That about wraps us up for news. And now I think we should get into our in-depth discussion, chat, rant. Yep. What else are we doing about horror?
They're eating her. And then they're going to eat me. Oh, my God!
Horror comics. It's one of those few genres which you can't really avoid. It's always sort of clung on through periods of huge interest and then periods where no one really cares about horror comics, would you say?
Yeah, like the Western or,
I think it's survived longer than the Western because it doesn't have that cultural aspect or that historical element. And horror you can transplant to modern days. And recently we've seen a bit of a horror boom in Hollywood. Yeah. And of course there's the zombie and vampire boom of the current day. But
which
you could
won't die.
And you could say it all kind of started with Frankenstein and Dracula and then, of course, like the 1930s films, the classic horror films.
Yes, Nosferatu.
Yes. But horror comics is a whole another kettle of fish. Of course, they first started with adapting comic versions of Dracula and Frankenstein and those. But there were horror comics before then. You have like 12th century Japanese scrolls of traditional horror. They would tell their stories in this kind of comic format, almost sequential panels. And you also had the Mixtec Aztecs, in South America, all their historical scrolls are also in a comic format, and they would tell horror stories as well. So
like people being disemboweled for their tentacled gods and things.
Yeah, I guess does non-fiction count as horror? So I think it's not just a Western fascination. It's I think everyone around the world has some sort of interest in horror.
We like being scared.
But the first American horror comics, and I guess the honor of the first standalone horror comic book is shared between Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from Classic Comics and Eerie Comics from Avon Periodicals. And I'm going to give it to Eerie Comics because it's an original. They started doing original horror stories. Yep. And the first horror comics, you've got your EC horror comics. They were really gruesomely scripted and illustrated, and there were stories of ghosts and ghouls and zombies, vampires, haunted graveyards, and there was always sexual perversion and sadism and torture. Cannibalism came up a lot, and people would lose their minds frequently. And it's quite out there, considering you usually think of the 40s as this very tame period for comics. 40s and 50s and so forth. But that was after these comics. And a recent book that collects a lot of these most interesting stories, I think I may have showed it to you the other day.
You're right. I mean, a lot of these short stories are shorter. Mm. They're all full colour. They're all actual comics, but they're not continual narratives necessarily. But this book that you're talking about, there's some big ideas in there.
Oh, yeah.
They're quite funny. Mm. And I think we've kind
humor
of lost
horror.
That idea. Everything's trying to be so dark and adult that we've kind of lost the black humor. In
well, I almost don't agree with you there because comedy and horror still stick together, except now it's more the comedy is kind of dumber. Like, that guy got his head ripped off. That's funny. It's not actually the humor is in the gore today. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, rather than back in the 50s, 60s, the humor was more about just the characters and the actual
the irony
of the stories. Yeah.
The twist at the end would be like the, he got what's coming to him kind of humor,
Like the Twilight Zone kind of approach to storytelling.
But the book's called Four Color Fear. It's edited by Fantagraphics Books, and it came out last month, so now's a good time to pick it up. And, I was so impressed with these stories, eh? I wasn't quite sure what to expect. Considering, you see a lot of 40s and 50s comics and they're a little bit depressingly terrible, would be fair. This book features a lot of really quite well-known names. Reed Crandall, Howard Nostrand, Al Williamson, Wallace Wood, I'm sure you've heard of.
Yep.
And I'm almost certain there's an Archie Goodwin story or two in here because he was incredibly prolific.
Yes.
But some of the stories in here are crazy. There's one about a vampire who wants to make peace by starting a blood bank and, you know, live alongside humans. And this, you know, in the 50s, it's being done now, True Blood, and so, you know, so
yeah.
Original idea, my ass. But and then all the vampires get fat from living slovenly, unexciting okay. lives. There's a cactus who's going around killing people. There's this great story where the scientist makes this, like an organ bank, and it's basically a wall of flesh. And he tries to murder a woman by pushing her into it, and she's being absorbed into this pink pulsating wall of goo. They're very imaginative, these stories. And there's obviously the fun ones, like where a guy decides to try and murder his wife and he plans his scheme and then he gets what's coming to him at the end when her ghost comes to him. Yeah, a lot of really entertaining stories, and originality was, I think, the key in those days.
Yes.
To really
there was
stand
one
out.
I remember you showed me where a ghoul comes out of the ground and moves in with this couple and won't leave or something.
Yeah, that's hilarious. And there's a great twist at the end as well.
He's just sitting at home smoking on a pipe, putting his feet up, and he's like a decomposing corpse.
Yeah, they discover him, like, they wake up in the middle of the night and he's raiding their fridge. Just eating this steak, something from frozen from the fridge, is great. And one really hilarious story has a horror comics writer and his editors like hounding him for new stories and I need new original work, it's not crazy enough, you know.
Yeah.
But it sort of all rose to a point where I think they crossed the boundaries of good taste, and that was in the say the 1950s, the mid 1950s, so much so that in 1954 there were congressional hearings targeted towards horror and violent yes. comic books, trying to work out their contribution to juvenile delinquency crisis. And that was all kind of sped on by a famous figure called Dr. Frederick Wortham,
yep.
I'm sure we've both heard of.
Oh, yes. Much reviled around comic book community.
Yep. But you could say he was responsible for the superhero boom. Directly responsible. He wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent, where he basically tried to outline the connections between reading violent comic books and violent behavior. And it's an argument that's still being made today about violent video games, to be honest.
Correct. That's true. There's an awesome book which talks about this in detail. It's called The 10-Cent Plague. It's by David Hajdu, H-A-J-D-U. And the subtitle is The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. And, yeah, it's hard to believe, but, yeah, in the 50s there was, like, book burnings. Because, I mean, some of these comic covers, like, were grotesque. I mean, this
is... Oh, for sure.
And kids, they were publicly displayed and stuff, but...
One that came up in the hearings has an axe murderer holding a woman's severed head on the cover
yes.
in grotesque close-up. I don't remember if there's blood dripping from her neck, but you may as well imagine it's there. And
there was always crime stories with, you know, eyeballs exploding and women in, you know, next to nothing and that kind of stuff. So it always, I think the...
It was a mix of sadism and sex and violence, which people were a bit funny about. So much so, you did mention the book burnings, yeah. Like, children were encouraged to, by their parents, teachers and clergymen, you know, to pile their comics in the schoolyard and light a bonfire.
It's looking at the book now, the 10-Cent Plague, and there's photos of it.
Oh,
comics
boy.
On fire in St. Patrick's Academy in Binghamton, New York, 1949.
Bring tears to your eye, Chris.
Yeah. it's pretty bad.
I've only ever once lit a book on fire. It was a Wonder Woman comic. It was that where Joker becomes a cross-dressing character. Don't worry. It's terrible.
What?
I've lit a comic on fire once. I've got photos. We'll put it on the site.
So glad we're doing this on Skype today.
Yeah, you would throttle me.
If it wasn't for the trains, whatever they do, then I'd be there. It's a fascinating time, though. I mean, this would be ripe for a documentary. I don't think there is one, but it would be an awesome documentary to be made about this time. But, yeah, you're right in saying that... the Comics Code Authority and a lot of publishing restrictions, publishers boom and bust during and after this time.
That's right.
It was quite a pivotal time, not only for, you know, kind of boys growing up who wanted their horror fix, but just the comics industry in general.
Yeah, that's for sure. I've got this great quote from a dude called John Mason Brown of the Saturday Review of Literature, who described comics as the marijuana of the nursery, the bane of the bassinet, the horror of the house, the curse of the kids, and the threat to the future. So that
wow.
Thank you.
Sounds like he's talking about communism or something.
Yeah, exactly. You can see how people get riled up about this. And out of all of this, you got the formation of the Comics Code Authority, which you mentioned, which is a subset of the Comics Magazine Association of America. So the comic book industry was basically forced to self-regulate, and the code forbade the explicit representation of scenes of excessive violence, brutal torture, physical agony, horror, bloodshed, gory, gruesome crimes, depravity, lust, sadism, masochism, or scenes dealing with or instruments associated with the Walking Dead or torture.
Yeah, there couldn't be supernatural elements. There couldn't even be like words like crime or terror in the title, I believe. I think EC kind of got around this. Was EC who made their comics into a magazine format?
No, that's Warren Publishing who did that later. What companies like EC and DC and I guess was Marvel around at the stage? No.
They were, but they weren't really doing horror kind of stuff.
Yeah, but the ones who were doing horror comics sort of, they tried to keep those comics. DC's House of Mystery and House of Secrets didn't have terror or horror in the title, and that title just shifted to suspense and mystery with kind of science fiction, and House of Mystery became a superhero title.
Yeah.
The Martian Manhunter, I believe, part of that title. And at that point, I guess the heyday of horror comics was officially over. So after this huge boom, so many publishers went bust, and it left a huge void that was then filled by the science fiction and superhero comics.
Yeah, in the mid to late 1950s, the Silver Age, what we call the Silver Age period of time began. So, yeah, superheroes came back onto the market, mainly thanks to DC, and then Marvel, who were then timely. Marvel came in the early 60s, so Spider-Man, Fantastic Four. Mm. That was just such a... I mean, horror had kind of had its days, and now it's the superheroes' time to shine, and they still haven't left us.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Well, some of the superheroes were directly inspired by that horror boom, and I think they were trying to still appeal to those audiences. So in 62, Stan Lee creates The Hulk, which he said, you know, in interviews that he was a direct combination of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know, the man turns into the monster and Frankenstein. And there's, you know, a quote from Stan Lee saying he wanted a, you know, a monster that was good, but nobody knows it. So, I guess I could try and do his voice. What does he sound like?
I'd
always loved the movie Frankenstein, and it seemed to me that the monster played by Boris Karloff wasn't really a bad guy. No, that wasn't good, was it?
That was okay if he was directing a circus. That would be okay.
Step right up. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good quote. It's like, he was a good guy. He didn't want to hurt anyone. It's just these idiots with torches kept running up and down the mountains, the mountains chasing him and getting him angry. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to create a monster and make him the good guy? It's like, Stan Lee, you're a great dude.
That's true. That's also, if you notice, the first couple issues of Fantastic Four, the Thing was quite prominent because they were still getting over their monster/horror period.
Of course.
And I think in the first issue, they didn't even have their costumes on. So Marvel was sure, this is 1961, so Marvel were quite unsure about the whole superhero thing and if it was going to work. So the Fantastic Four number one, that doesn't even look like a superhero book.
Yeah, it's very science fiction-y with this this kind of horror monster element. Yeah, that's genius, my friend, genius. And a lot of publishers in the period were trying to get around the comics code. Some of them were doing just adaptations of classic horror literature, and you know, if you're adapting literature, you get a bit of leeway.
Yes.
But in the case of Warren Publishing, who you mentioned earlier, they put out the now famous Creepy and Eerie and Vampirella volumes, which they published as magazines. So it had to be in black and white. It was in a standard magazine format, and it was a higher book price. I think it was like 35 cents rather than 12.
Yep.
And that's how they got around it. So in the pages of Creepy, which are now being collected by Dark Horse, the Archives volumes, have you picked up any of those?
I haven't, but you've got a couple, haven't you? But I have seen gorgeous. Some old ones.
Mm, really, really good collections of and reproductions. And Dynamite, I think, is right now, I think, as of this month, putting out the original Vampirella.
Yes.
Archives. But yeah, great magazine. You got Archie Goodwin, who wrote a lot of the stories, Frank Frazetta, Neil Adams, Gerald Lando, Reed Crandall, Alex Toth, Wally Wood, Richard Corbin, who... And Bernie Wrightson, who did a great Frankenstein adaptation at some point in the 70s as well. And also, I found this interesting, it features the first interracial kiss in a mainstream comic.
Oh, okay.
In 72. And that was Creepy 43, progressive. And apparently it was because the artist misunderstood a note in the script.
Okay.
Yeah, nice. Classic comics. But progressive stuff. Creepy and Eerie, I think, is some volumes you should pick up if you're at all interested in the history of comics, because they've aged really well.
Yes.
The artwork's very like very professional, very high-end artwork, and has that adventure comic vibe. Have I showed you any of my Japanese horror comics around the same time?
No, I've only seen your modern Japanese stuff, but none of the older stuff.
Yeah. In Japan, around the same period, like the, I guess, the late 60s, the Japanese horror comic was beginning to develop. And, I mean, the Japanese comics were, at that point, were just starting to come into their own. And they sort of drew on the Western comics and monster movies for their horror. And also, they blended with a really rich tradition of their, you know, their own supernatural stories.
Yes.
Yeah. And at that period, you had key works like Shigeru Mizuki's Kitara of the Graveyard. He did Doraemon. I don't know if you know that little blue guy. Yes. He's I think he's Japan's anime ambassador officially now. Yeah. And that was an extrapolation of a Japanese folktale. And you also have Kazuo Umezu's Drifting Classroom, which is about a whole school of kids whose school is like suddenly transplanted to this other dimension where the world's basically been destroyed. And it's just a crater left in the modern day, and they go all Lord of the Flies on each other. One teacher goes crazy and kills all the other teachers and loses his mind. And the kid tries to leave messages to reach his mom, and the kids start killing each other. And because it's drawn in, it's very quite friendly cartoon style. It's really disturbing to see them kill each other. But post 71, you had another relaxation of the comics code. So they could do traditional comics again. And then you had a second boom. And that's where...
Yeah, this is a period where more supernatural stuff started to happen. So, especially Marvel and DC. So you had characters like the Living Mummy, and then, various incarnations of Draculas and werewolves and that kind of stuff. They're kind of a combination of...
I think Draculas would be called vampires, would they?
What's that?
Would Draculas be called vampires by any chance?
Well, yes, but they were, spins on, like, so you'd have...
And this was the same time as, the Hammer Horror films?
Oh, yes. Yeah, have just made a resurgence now, haven't they?
Yeah, they're, that cult horror thing is popular again. What was it, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing? He always played Helsing quite often. He was Grand Moff Tarkin in Star Wars, for those who don't know. And Christopher Lee played Count something.
Count Dooku.
In the prequel, I will not mention anymore. That never happened.
Episode something of the something.
Yeah, Attack of the Something. Attack of George Lucas's creditors. I don't know. But yeah, the second horror boom was like from 71 to 75, and it was really quite a lucrative period, especially for Charlton, Marvel, DC, and Skywald. And obviously Marvel and DC are still around from that, so right on, guys. And they all rode that boom in horror comics. And during that period, you saw titles like Blade. The Wesley Snipes vehicle has many.
He's English, A lot of people think the character's American.
I thought you meant Wesley Snipes was English. Whoa, you blew my mind for a second.
He's English.
Yeah, he was a spin-off of their Dracula comic, I think. I didn't know he was English.
Mm. Yeah, and there's a big vampire thing going through Marvel's X-Men titles at the moment that Blade plays a big part in. While we're talking about 70s comics, I just want to mention something that I picked up this week, which is a Marvel one-shot called Tomb of Terror. And Marvel have been doing these on occasion. They'll just do one-shots around a particular theme. Usually it's a character. But this one is just in time for Halloween. So it's a collection of four shorter stories, 48 black and white pages.
Mm-hmm.
It's parental advisory, and it's called A Tomb of Terror. Hmm. So there's a Man-Thing story.
Right, who also started in the 70s,
There's a Son of Satan, who I think even had his own series in the 70s. Tale. There's a Werewolf by Night, and there's also lastly a tale of the Living Mummy written by Joe Lansdale, which is mainly a prose piece with some art, and it's pretty cool. So yeah, it's black and white, four horror stories. The art styles couldn't be more different from each other. They're pretty gruesome, but it's very 70s, even just looking at the cover. 48 all new pages in glorious black and white. Super issue, more chills. It's kind of designed like a classic 70s comic, and on the back it's got a serial called Mummy Yummies, totally devoid of minerals or vitamins. It's pretty cool. There's also, because you mentioned Bernie Wrightson earlier.
Yes.
There's a DC book which have just been released. It's another one-shot. It's called Batman Hidden Treasures.
Right, yeah, I heard of this.
It's written by, it's basically a lost tale. Marvel and DC have a lot of lost tales where you, something will be commissioned, the editor will leave, and then it'll just stay in somebody's drawer for decades and decades and never see the light of day. This is I don't know how old it is, but it can't be that old, maybe 15, 20 years.
Right.
It's written by Ron Mars, drawn by Bernie Wrightson, who's known for his kind of horror sensibilities.
Of course.
And again, it's a Batman Solomon Grundy tale told from this point of view of a hobo. So he's basically recounting the story of how Batman and Solomon Grundy fought. So there's a page of prose and a page of art. So it's more of a prose piece. Okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. And yeah, Bernie Wrightson's art just looks awesome. Very organic and fluid, and he does Batman awesomely.
Yeah.
And then there's a reprint in this same issue, which from 1973 by Len Wein, and again, illustrated by Bernie Wrightson. But it's been recolored by Alex Sinclair, and it's called Night of the Bat, and it's originally published in Swamp Thing number 7. Oh. And it's very obvious that it's quite a 70s kind of tale. But it's just amazing how awesome colour can make something look like just the new colouring of this 1973 tale just brings it to life.
Is it that kind of shiny colouring that I hate, or is it nice?
It's more toned. I think this might even be the same guy that did DC's Identity Crisis colouring. So it's quite toned, but yeah, you know, like everything's glowing and humming, and it's very natural.
Okay.
I like it. So, yeah, it's called Batman Hidden Treasures.
And that's out now, is it? Yeah.
That's out now.
Yeah, I just heard of that recently. It's quite interesting, yeah.
I'll lend it to you. It is very good.
Thank you, sir. Very kind of you.
I'm a generous man.
Of course you are. Another title that got a start in that sort of period of the 70s, Ghost Rider. The famous Nicolas Cage character.
Which they're doing a sequel to.
Yeah. Aren't we both excited about that?
Oh, boy.
Are they filming it in Australia again?
I don't know, actually. I don't know.
Could other Fat Cage Pizza characters? I can't believe they had Fat Pizza characters on that in that movie.
That's not going to mean anything to non-Australian listeners.
I know, but it means something to me. They've been doing like TV commercials lately. Really washed up.
Really?
Yeah, like the whole cast did like a one of those car company,
The
places that sell car accessories. You know, that kind of crap.
Okay.
Yeah, but Swamp Thing, and also Swamp Thing got a start in the 70s, but he was kind of a different character at that point.
That's true. Yeah, Alan Moore kind of created an entirely different character for him in a way.
Well, he definitely did. That happened. Should we move on to the 80s, if that's all right with you? Yeah. That is kind of the main kind of catalyst of the 80s horror comics was Karen Berger at DC kind of decided to relaunch Swamp Thing, and she gave Alan Moore free rein to experiment and revamp the character, and he sort of turned it into a straight-up monster, but really concentrated on making the monster make sense from its own perspective, and gave it an inner sort of character that wasn't there before, and it was a huge critical and commercial success, as we both know. Have you read much of Alan Moore Swamp Thing?
Neither.
That's one thing that's kind of been a black hole in my comic book literacy. It's next on my list, I'd imagine. But saw spin-offs like Hellblazer that started in 88, the John Constantine character, London's underground magician kind of guy, wears a yellow trench coat, and he started off as quite a dapper sort of sting kind of from the police kind of character. That's what he looked like.
Yes.
Since he's become a bit more of a scruffy cigarette chain smoking constant 5 o'clock shadow kind of character, and that was in 88 and still ongoing, so one of DC's longest running non-superhero titles.
Is it
their only non-superhero ongoing title?
Vertigo have a lot, but they haven't lasted as long as Hellblazer, but that's got to be the longest running one for sure.
Yeah, that whole thing inspired a third minor supernatural horror trend, and it was enough for them to launch a whole new line, you know, Vertigo. And from that you saw Sandman, Neil Gaiman's classic about the sort of like the Lord of All Dreaming. It's a really good comic, if I guess everyone here has heard of it, surely.
Yes.
Except our newbies. But it's a really approachable book for newbies, and the current trades of it being put out in the new Absolute Edition coloring.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you know how the first three or four volumes were recolored for the big Absolute Edition because some people don't like the old coloring. I love it, but that's just me. Now's a really good time to grab the trades if you're interested, and you were put off by kind of a clunky sort of late 80s bad technique coloring. Yeah. So grab those if you can. And, I mean, the effect of this whole boom is still still felt throughout all the other publishers, you know, and really through the 90s you got this whole, these horror books, so late 80s and early 90s are really original. Have you noticed that? They tried lots of different things, and you got Hellboy from that period.
Yeah, that's true. Mike Mignola.
Mm-hmm. Which we've both read a fair chunk of, I'd imagine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And another character that's still going and kind of has a whole universe created around him.
Mm. And Batman Gothic also came out of the period. Have you read this one?
I haven't, but I know I have read like Batman Bloodstorm and Gotham by Gaslight and that kind of Elseworlds tales, which are a bit more horror-y.
Yeah, the Kelly Jones vampire ones as well, Red Rain. Yep, also from that same period. So that the supernatural horror element started to merge into superheroes, which you had this whole interesting new genre, but which I don't think anyone's really written about. I'm trying to find, like, the more information I try to find about supernatural superhero tales, it's kind of, it is a subset genre. I'd like to, someone should write a book. Me, perhaps.
Yes, get to it.
Yeah, but Batman Gothic was written by Grant Morrison, who's still currently writing Batman. He can't get away from Batman, can he?
No.
Yeah, and Klaus Janson, who was the inker on Dark Knight Returns.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah, he worked with Frank Miller a fair bit. And the story has, there's this, basically this ghost of a murdered gangster is going around killing people, and Batman's trying to work out what's happening, and you can't beat up a ghost. So Batman kind of has to use his detective and reasoning skills to work out this mystery. It's really creepy. Some of the, there's murders and stuff in it that's quite unpleasant, and there's a bit of a mini conspiracy from what I recall of it. I will lend it to you. I think you'd enjoy it.
Yep. Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah. Any other 90s ones you wanted to mention?
Not really. Well, I guess I could talk about The Goon.
Of course, yeah. Tell me about it.
The Goon, kind of like Hellboy, is kind of like a creator-owned character that's that's a bit off-kilter. I mean, I think the Hellboy films are more funny than the Hellboy comics. The Hellboy comics aren't really funny.
Mm.
But The Goon sure is. That Goon got started by writer-artist Eric Power in the late 1990s.
Right.
Before then being collected and published by Dark Horse, and it's still going. It's kind of on hiatus at the moment, I believe, but he's writing, he's currently writing Billy the Kid's Old Timey Oddities, which is like a kind of Western horror kind of title. So that's out now, Eric Power, and it's also each issue features the Goon backup. So the Goon, there's about a dozen trades out now, all from Dark Horse. And as we said earlier, there's a CGI Goon film being produced by David Fincher.
What is The Goon? Describe it to me.
The Goon is, it's set in 1940s with a kind of an assortment of zombies and monsters and ghosts in a world where everyone is ugly. So it's kind of like a bizarro noir world, like Hitchcock through the eyes of a bizarro world.
Mm.
So monsters and stuff are commonplace. There's a lot of kind of cheeky Monty Python-y absurdist humour.
Right.
And the Goon himself, who's the main character, is like this kind of self-appointed protector of the of his local neighbourhood.
Okay.
Protecting him from all rampaging manner of beasts. And he's like got a little, little, you know, hat on, and he's like this big hulking guy with an overbite and scars on his face, and you don't really see his eyes. Well, he describes himself, this is a quote, as a shaved gorilla with 20 pounds of ground beef for a head.
He does look like a gorilla. Yeah, that's a good call.
So, the main bad guy who pops up every now and then is called the Nameless Man. He's a zombie priest, and he's kind of building this army of the undead. It's pretty cool. So the volume one is called Nothing But Misery. It's got I mean, Eric Power's a great writer and artist, and he does these wonderful painted covers. So, the interior art doesn't necessarily indicate what a great artist he is. That's not to say that Jerry Art's not awesome, but it gets more polished in the later volumes. But here what happens is it's just basically a collection of loose stories. It's quite cartoony but quite expressive and quite humorous art. Right. There's a great sequence in here where there's this new character called the Buzzard, and he's like this old guy with big wide eyes. And there's his origin is all done in a sepia style. Basically, this zombie priest put a spell on him when he was a sheriff, and now he's like, instead of becoming a zombie who eats the flesh of the living. He became someone who must now eat the flesh of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like a cannibal, but a zombie cannibal. And it's quite reminiscent of the old kind of creepy art, I think, and especially some of those quite expressive covers. Oh, it's cool. Quite absurd, quite funny, and funny regularly. Like, you know how sometimes it's comedy comics, but maybe once every 10 pages there's a mildly amusing gag. But I can honestly say The Goon is probably the funniest comic I've ever read, and out loud. Like, wow, I've laughed out loud. There's regular characters in there, like Bartender Norton, Frankie, who's like this big wide-eyed, angry, skinny runt of a man, Frankie, who's like his psychic. And then there's one where he takes his date to a magic show, but we never see her face. And there's this psychic seal who tells the pair about this one-eyed alien crime lord. There's this big hulking Santa who kind of beats his elves, and then the elves are like really ugly and they eat the local children. It's quite weird. I mean, each of the stories are kind of self-contained, but yeah, the art's quite expressive. Great line work. There's fake ads in there as well. So, like, there's ads for do-it-yourself home lobotomy kit. All the brains come from convicts, stuff like that. So, it's very tongue-in-cheek. It's not, I mean, it's not, certainly not one for the kids, but it's, you know, there's no, it's not over the top in its depiction of violence and stuff. It's very,
okay. If you, I'm curious to check it out. You said that it's quite funny. I didn't.
It's very silly and very funny.
Ah, okay.
Also, Slave Labor Graphics, they've got a book out called Pinocchio, the Vampire Slayer.
Hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of this. It's black and white. It's kind of more of digest size.
Hmm.
The sequel is actually out at the moment, or out very soon. That's called Pinocchio, the Vampire Slayer and the Great Puppet Theatre. But this is black and white art. It's quite simple art. It's not the best art in the world, but it's quite, again, very simple and expressive enough when it needs to be. Great use of blacks. It's written by Van Jensen, created and drawn by Dusty Higgins, and pretty much the title tells you all you need to know. But they actually, the guys actually managed to get a pretty emotional and satisfying story out of it. You know, there's characters that die, and then there's Pinocchio. It's done not in a tongue-in-cheek style. Like, it takes itself seriously, and it does have funny, light-hearted moments in it, like when he's talking to the, you know, Jiminy Cricket and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It actually has more in tone with the actual original tale of Pinocchio, Carlo Collodi, back decades, even centuries ago, I guess, rather than, say, the Disney film. It's quite angular, quite hard-edged in its line, and good use of duotones to kind of show shading. So, yeah, that's Pinocchio the Vampire Slayer.
Another comic that's quite hard-edged and angular. I reread this week Stray Toasters by Bill Sienkiewicz.
A book I've heard of, but I've never even seen.
Yeah, it's basically, if you're going to talk about Bill Sienkiewicz's work, it's probably one of his most sort of seminal works, and the one that's had the most effect. His style, I guess you could say, is a little bit of Dave McKean by way of Frank Miller.
Yep.
I think that's a fairly good description. The book, he does multiple, what's it called? Multimedia, that's what I'm looking for. So pens, crayons even, paint, ink, everything. It's all sort of blended together, and it's a very, very strange psychological horror story, which starts with a murder of a woman by a man with a toaster for a head.
Yeah.
And there's this story that begins to unfold between this guy who's investigating it, who kind of looks like Clancy Brown again.
It's coming back.
Yeah, and he's trying to investigate this, and it seems like all the women in his life are somehow involved in what's happening, and there's his children being abducted, and it's quite disturbing, and there's a great character in it called Mr. Violet, which is basically this huge, overweight, blue blob man who has these crows for minions, and he talks through his big head brace, which is a bit Juggernaut-esque. He's just wired up, and he rides around on this little train track because he can't move, like this tiny little train track. He's, I will not be made to look ridiculous, while he's riding on this tiny train. And I reckon I'll bring this up again when I talk about when we do our favorite death scenes, which I think we'll do in another couple of weeks, because his death scene's awesome. I like this book more the first time I read it, but I find the stories really hard to fathom at times because the pages are so claustrophobic, intentionally so. He switches between very tight panels, which sort of there's like a six panel layout, and all six panels sort of make up a larger picture, but you know, there'll be text running between them, you know, like, and it gives you this feeling of being trapped in this very small space. It's quite uncomfortable book to read, and it takes you out of your comfort zone, both in its content and its presentation. So it's quite challenging. I'd recommend picking it up if you're interested in experimental graphic novels, especially from that sort of 90s period. And another one that we've both read, Uzumaki, Spirals.
Yes. Ooh, that was freaky.
Did you like it?
I did like it.
Yeah.
It was... I don't know how to explain it, but I did like it.
It's by Junji Ito, who, I guess in Japan, like, that whole horror boom was still going and sort of been developing in its own way, and it's very uniquely Japanese, and we all know Japanese horror stands quite apart from American horror.
Yes.
You know, you can see it in the films, but the comics are the same thing. I mean, he created Tomie, which was kind of like this demon girl who... her thing was she was so beautiful that men would kill her rather than let her any other men have her, and she would come back and murder them. So she kept going through these cycles of driving men crazy to the point of them murdering her. So it's almost the opposite of like someone who goes around murdering people. She would cause them to kill her. It was very strange. Really good one. Gyo, which I don't think I've lent you, but I need to. That one's about like these robot fish which invade Japan. Fish, it's fish who have legs. So, like, all of a sudden, one day, basically, all the fish walk out of the ocean, and these great white sharks on robotic legs eating people and stuff. Really, like, basically on spider legs kind of things. It's really quite creepy, but very funny at the same time. He does the tongue-in-cheek thing. And Uzumaki, which is this one, which is Spiral into Horror in the English editions. Viz Media put it out, I think, a couple of years ago. You can still get them, definitely. Spirals basically invade a small town. It's very hard to explain, but spirals in every iteration, sort of everyone becomes very obsessed with the shape of the spiral, but things that are spiral shaped, like say the eardrum, like begins to drive people crazy. This guy, the dad of the main, I guess the main protagonist's boyfriend, he becomes obsessed with the shape and starts making these pottery and then turns himself into a spiral by wrapping himself into a curve. There's a girl who's so hypnotically beautiful that her head just sort of melts into this spiral. Do you remember that panel? And her eyeball spins around.
The worst one I remember was... wasn't a guy that turned into a snail or something?
Yeah.
In the middle of the classroom?
Because he was always late to class.
Yeah.
And they were like, God, it would always be on rainy days. He'd always be, he'd only ever turn up to school on rainy days, and he was always late to class. So like a snail, you know, come out when it rains. He slowly begins to turn into a snail. And then the one kid who always teased him and gave him crap also turns into a snail, and they have a hermaphroditic relationship. this book is like nothing else you've ever read, I would say.
It sounds like hilarious when we... say it, but when you read it, it's not funny at all.
Yeah, like at the end of a story, you just have to laugh, like, oh my God, I can't believe that. But some of the stuff that happens is so creepy. Like these two kids fall in love and they're both from poor families. And at the end of the story, they just start twisting and entwining themselves with each other so their families could never tear them apart. And it's incredibly creepy.
It is.
Oh, gosh.
It's very effective. It's a very effective comic with such an emotional response when you read it. And the art is just suitably creepy.
Yeah. And, any idea you could think of with spirals, water spirals, smoke spirals, there's a really creepy bit with a hospital and babies and mushrooms. Oh, that quite disturbed me, actually.
Yeah.
And it actually has an ending which fits the story, and it has an ending, thankfully. Yeah. And it's all these little vignettes, so it's really easy to read. So I definitely recommend checking out Uzumaki.
On a similar vein, I read something this week called Pixu. I don't know if you've heard of this, PIXU.
Go on.
Pixu, The Mark of Evil. It's also published by Dark Horse. It's kind of like it's almost a Japanese approach to storytelling, but almost with a European kind of art style to it. It's got a great red cover. Basically, the story is by Gabriel Barr and Fabio Moon, twin Brazilian brothers who do Umbrella Academy, Day Tripper, that kind of stuff. Becky Cloonan, artist of Demo Vertigo series, which is awesome. Kind of slice day in the life of kind of supernatural, superpowered slices of life. And Vasilis Lolos from The Last Call.
Yeah, I know Vasilis Lolos. Yeah, he does good work. He did yeah, that's it. And he's also in this other horrible convention later. But sorry, go on.
Awesome. So Pixu is basically a collection of, well, these four artists kind of work their magic together. So it follows, each artist will follow a separate character in this tenement building, this apartment building. Mm. And if you've seen the film Dark Water, the Japanese film, which was then remade with Jennifer Connelly, where like a dark smudge stain kind of appears on the wall and then kind of grows and gets life. I don't know if that's ringing any bells.
No.
It's very similar. So this strange mark kind of appears in this apartment block. And then it centres on the few residents in the apartment block and how they react to kind of the supernatural shenanigans going on around them. So originally it starts off quite slow, like these lovers break up and then they get back together and she like starts to act quite silent and withdrawn and weird, and then he's eating soup that she made and he finds that she put her fingernails in there. And then like she's trying to sleep him, sleeping she cuts all his hair off, and then there's this creepy bit where this girl in the goes over to a neighbor's house and she just paints all over his bedroom, and there's lots of throat slashing going on and people being stabbed with various homemade implements, lots of visions and fire. So the artwork is quite, again, it's black and white, quite creepy, but I mean, I read it all three in one sitting. It's relatively short, but it's a really good read. It's, it's Pixu, not a happy book, but it's basically one in which a lot of bad stuff happens to, not bad people, but just people.
Wow.
Yeah, it's called Pixu, the Mark of Evil. It's kind of hard to describe it because it doesn't have a traditional narrative, just a lot of freaky stuff happens. Mm. But it does remind me very much of a Japanese horror film in a lot of the stuff just comes out of nowhere and doesn't make sense. There's no explanations. So it just kind of pulls you along with the ride and it gets more and more intense as each page gets turned.
I like that sort of horror thing rather than the gore and played for laughs kind of deal.
Yeah, yeah.
But speaking of another Japanese horror, as you mentioned, Domu, I don't know if you've heard of this one, by Katsuhiro Otomo.
I haven't read it.
Who did the very famous Akira.
Whoever's
heard of Canada, Tetsuo.
Yes.
Just got to yell that over and over again. No, Dom was set in. Anyone who's been to Japan knows it's basically all these apartment towers are everywhere, and they say 20 or so floors, stories up, but they're sort of stacked right up next to each other. So they'll just have like blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks of these apartments. And in one of these apartment blocks, they're very claustrophobic feeling, and that's part of the mood of the story. And there's this psychic old man who basically has the run of the place and does whatever he wants, like this creepy hobo character, and then this little girl and child psychics who kind of challenge him. Very bloody, very disturbing at times, a lot of psychically controlled murders and people throwing themselves off top of buildings, very creepy stuff. It's strange. Katsuhiro Otomo is very well known for Akira, but no one's really read his other work.
Yeah.
And all of it's really good, so I kind of want to spread the word as much as I can. I don't know if it's still in print. I think Dark Horse did an edition of it a while ago.
Yeah.
But apparently there's a rights issue with it, as always bloody happens that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Have you heard of Strange Embrace by David Hein?
Yes, he's done some work for DC recently. I think he's doing some Batman stuff, but yes.
Was he working on Fantastic Four?
No.
No, who was that? Jason Aaron? No.
Jason Aaron is doing Wolverine. Fantastic Four is Jonathan Hickman.
Oh, Jonathan Hickman. Okay, now David Hein he was doing some DC comic. I don't keep up on that too much, so pardon my inexperience.
He's actually writing, he did write FVZA from Radical, which I did intend to read, but...
Okay.
I didn't. But yeah, it's great. It's kind of Federal Vampire and Zombie Agency.
Awesome.
It's basically, so it's a good combination of kind of horror and sci-fi kind of stuff. And the art by Roy Allen Martinez is pretty good. I think he's done a fair bit of horror stuff.
David Hein sort of really does an awesome job creeping the hell out.
And Strange Embraces must have been one of his earlier.
Yes,
works.
I think it was kind of one of the ones that sort of broke him into the industry a bit. It was an original sort of black and white miniseries that was later collected. I've been reading the collected edition by Active Images, but it has recently been put out in colour by Image Comics.
Cool.
And I think they collected the colour edition as well. And the colouring's quite nicely done. I would say they definitely did a low-key European single tone, not too much shading thing, to so it doesn't distract from his line art, which is very sharp, angular, and just very disturbing and just twisted perspectives and so forth. But the story kind of centres around this young man basically makes like a delivery to this house, and it's got this character in it called Alex, and or in the house, he's surrounded by all the ghosts of the people he's either led to kill themselves or killed, you know, himself.
Directly, yep.
And Alex is this creepy kind of... He's a bit like Loki.
Okay, from Thor.
Yeah, he doesn't look like the Thor edition, but you know how other artists will draw Loki with this really sharp face and this hair that's flying up in the air and stuff? That's what Alex is like, and is this very creepy character. And when he was a teenager, he was covered in acne, which... He looked as ugly as he was on the inside, was how the story goes. There's a lot of body horror in this. Alex becomes obsessed with this old... Alex is telling this story to this young guy, that he sort of became obsessed with this old recluse who lived in the house, and he makes it a game to break everyone, you know, mentally, that he meets, kind of thing. And this old guy called Anthony, his story makes up the main part of the main thrust of the story. And he was sort of had this puritanical mother who tried to keep him from growing up sexually, if you know what I mean.
Like,
tried to keep him innocent. And the way she does it is horrifying. And there's a big reveal at the end. And there's this woman who falls in love with him when he's in his 20s, and she doesn't understand why he's so distant and kind of crazy. And that story unwraps, and there's basically any creepy thing you could throw in. You know the 18th century insane asylums, how creepy and crazy they are? There's a lot of that sort of sequence. There's so much body horror, slashing murders. It's really, I'd say it's very underrated for a horror comic. It's one of the best ones I've ever read, to be honest.
Cool.
Yeah, Strange Embrace, David Hein, and lots of publishers have put it out, so it's not that hard to track down now. Highly, highly recommend it if you're at all into horror.
Another one which I can recommend is called Hotwire, Requiem for the Dead. It's another radical book, and this is a good combination of horror and sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
It's an idea from Warren Ellis and Steve Pugh, and Steve Pugh is the man. He's like, he takes control of this story. Basically, if you like 2000 AD, Judge Dredd, kind of cheeky English kind of humour, this is a pretty good, it's a luscious comic. He does this kind of this digital painting, which is just awesome. The new Hotwire miniseries Deep Cut is out now. The second issue of that comes out next week, so I'll be certainly mentioning it then. But basically, there's these things called blue lights, which are like ghosts who are kind of roaming in the streets and need a home kind of thing. So when they appear and people want to use them as weapons, this kind of albino, punky, goth girl called Alice Hotwire, who's a detective exorcist, and she kind of she works with the cops and she takes charge and kind of has to either cure these ghosts or kind of find them a home or that kind of thing. She uses lots of high-tech weapons, and there's like a riot going on in the city, and yeah, just lots of high-tech awesomeness. And it's one of the best looking pages you will ever see. Like, this would be a perfect example of someone to say, this is how awesome comic artwork can be. Steve Pugh, he did a series ages ago called Shark Man, and he doesn't always do this digital painting kind of style. He does pencil stuff as well, but this is an awesome book.
What's it called again?
It's called Hotwire Requiem for the Dead. Hotwire, so the trade paperback collecting the first miniseries is out now.
I'm adding it to my list.
Cool. Yeah, I'll lend it to you next time I see you. It's very luscious, painterly kind of artwork with a lot of,
Sounds like I'd enjoy it.
If you like Battlestar Galactica, but you think that it needs to be a bit more cheeky and with more brighter colours.
I'm so glad you said that. That's my exact feeling on that.
I mean, it's not spaceships and stuff, but it's kind of got that real tech kind of vibe about it.
Oh, cool. But, yeah, I'm just looking at it now. Really awesome art, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's very luscious. It's very...
And there's colour thrown in, thankfully, yeah. That's one thing I've...
Very colourful, and lots of ebbing lights and pulsating weapons and stuff.
Yeah, I can't describe the style very well. Yeah, but there's a good balance of white and black on the page. It's not just dreary. I've noticed that in a lot of modern horror comics. Very dreary looking. Washed out colours. And I don't want to say it's a criticism of this particular artist, but you know Ben Temple Smith.
Yes.
How his style, yeah, you have subdued colours. You have, it's very dark. It's very sort of disturbing and unpleasant to look at.
Yeah.
It's refreshing to see something have a bit more visual fun to it, if you know
what
I mean.
Well, I guess Hellraiser leans more towards a sci-fi than it does with horror, but it does have ghosts and possessions and that kind of stuff, which are kind of horror staples in it. Mm. It's awesome.
Mm.
And it's just a book that, with no previous experience of being a comics reader, you can hand to someone. Talking about Ben Templesmith, mm-hmm. Let's talk about Justin Randall. A lot of people kind of compare Justin Randall's artwork to Ben Templesmith. He's actually a local guy like us. He's a Perth guy.
So is Ben, isn't he? Wow.
Yes, they are.
That's strange that they're from the same space and similar style.
We have a lot of talented people here, not just the two of us.
For sure.
Changing Ways, which I recently read, is from a local publisher, Gestalt, who also do Rombies, which is like Roman zombies, and it's going to be an ongoing series very shortly. So, Changing Ways, it's the first book, so apparently there's going to be at least another two more, which is pretty good because it kind of ends with a definite cliffhanger. So are you familiar? Have you seen any of this artwork at all?
I have seen his artwork, and I just out of interest, I just tried to Google image him, and for some reason, every picture is a picture of Justin Timberlake. Is Justin Timberlake's real name Justin Randall?
Really?
I think it might. It's Justin Randall Timberlake. Oh.
Oh, is it?
So
oh, okay.
If you look up this guy, you might not have much luck. Because
I'm sure he has his own website.
I've seen Changing Ways on the shelf, and he did the cover for the character sketches book that Gestalt put out a while ago.
Yes.
So his style is really, the colouring's really gorgeous, I find. I really love that. Mm.
He's a design lecturer at, I think, Curtin University. If you go to justinrandall.com, you can see he's got a DeviantArt page as well. He's kind of similar to Ben Templesmith, but I think Ben goes a bit more abstract in his kind of work. Justin Randall seems to be a lot more realistic.
I'd say so.
Especially expressive faces. There's, I don't know if he does use photos, but it's very... And like you said about the colouring, it doesn't use, like, even if you just flick through the colours, there's not a lot of colours that are used, but somehow it just works really well. Like, there's so much black on the page, but it's never annoying or never that it's obscuring things.
Yeah, he tones a page, so you'll see, like, red and orange will be, like, dominant colours, but it'll be a colour scheme, so the whole page will have that kind of red sort of finish or green, you know, depending on what's happening and what time it is, you know. You get a... I guess it's a cohesive tone more so than Ben Templesmith, who does, as you said, have a more cartoony aspect to the way he draws characters.
Yeah.
A little bit more, Justin, he looks like he works from photo
it's
images.
It's pretty realistic. Like, the faces are very expressive, and you can just see the terror and the humour, and that, like, there's no, and every person looks different. Like, you.
I think it adds a lot to it. Mm.
Yeah. You don't need little captions telling you who the people are and stuff. It's very easy to follow. Basically, I should say what it's about. It is a horror book, and basically, like, even after the first few pages, you just know something bad is going to happen. So this ex-prison officer, David Barrett, his wife, very pregnant wife, and young daughter, Jessie, are the three main protagonists of the book. It starts quite quickly, and there's this real sense of foreboding running throughout all of the book, kind of like a Hitchcock film, or even like Alien, the first Alien film.
Oh, right, okay.
Like, even when stuff wasn't happening, you knew that just around the corner something bad was going to happen. It's kind of got that vibe about it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even in the quiet moments, you know that things are just going to get worse. So it starts with David and his daughter. They've been collecting these dead bugs that have been having strange red marks on them, and so he kind of keeps them in jars. And then the neighbor's dog attacks them, and then his owner comes over looking for the dog, and then David shoots him, and then later David and his wife reveal that they to each other that they've actually had these red marks on them for a while now, but too scared to tell each other.
Mm.
Things get weird, so they all leave town. It's kind of like George Romero's early zombie films, like this, just a slice of life with this big picture going happening, just a few people trying to make sense of the madness around them. Or like The Light, which I mentioned, I think, last week by Nathan Edmondson,
mm-hmm.
which is an image series. So, yeah, and then it's interesting, like, after I read the last page, I was like, there's a lot of horror tropes and a lot of horror stuff that we'd see in films. Like, there's the weird hitchhiker, Mm-hmm. And who, like, cuts himself, and then he's got a red mark, and he uses it to heal himself. There's a dark and seedy motel. There's people shuffling down dark roads. There's a blackout in prison cell. There's this mysterious compound and the shifty organization behind it. There's these wild pigs. There's these two local cops that have no idea what's happening, and they think David's a killer. There's kind of all this. A lot actually happens in this book. But it's all in quite a cohesive and natural way, that it's never overpowering, like, wait till I show you my next big idea. it's all a very natural part of the storytelling process. One of those things I mentioned seem like you've kind of seen them in horror films or whatever before, but it's handled in such a unique way that it's never, like, jarring or obvious. And then there's little things like David can bend steel with his bare hands, and then his wife gets, like, super hearing, and his daughter can talk to spirits. But it's never handed in a typical, here's my origin superhero way, let's go fight crime. It's not a superhero book at all. And little things like that are just throwaway lines, like, oh, I just met, how did you just get to prison? I just sprang the steel bars, you know. It's very weird. And there's hints to the next two books to come. There's a four-page sketchbook where he kind of just shows his initial pencils, and you can kind of see just the progress between just his kind of digital wizardry. It's very moody, it's a bit of profanity, it's quite violent in places. Again, very freaky, not in that Japanese kind of freaky way, but just in, bad stuff happening. Changing ways. Book one, Gestalt.
Yeah, Gestalt Publishing do good work, and I've noticed they have a few other horror books out. Rumbies is another one.
Yep.
I think that's been properly launched, hasn't it?
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. And all of this is available through Diamond Distribution. It's not just some Australian thing. But a book that we haven't had a chance to check out yet, but is also Australian, but you won't be able to get it through Diamond, unfortunately. Only in newsstands, which we thought was interesting. It's a company. What did we say the company was called? Hold on. Black House Comics. And they put out some Sherlock Holmes, kind of supernatural, the Dark Detective Sherlock Holmes, that's it.
Yes.
And they're putting out a comic called Eek! So EEK exclamation point. Yeah. And sort of as a tribute to the creepy and eerie kind of comics. And they're doing it through newsstands, as we mentioned, as a sort of continuing series, I hope, because the first issue's just come out. And it's written and drawn by Jason Polis, who works on Mad Magazine and Green Lantern, apparently. And do you remember Hairbutt the Hippo?
Yes.
Yep, he worked on that. Cool. And his visual style, he's obviously gone for like an Al Williamson, early Bernie Wrightson sort of creepy, eerie look on this, and it's very effective. It looks like it could have come straight out of one of those creepy, eerie comics. I'd recommend checking it out if you possibly can and you're in Australia. And this isn't just some crappy book I'm recommending. It actually looks really good. Yeah.
But that's a pretty good I've said all my horror pieces, I need to say. Yeah. If you've got anything else you want to recommend?
Not in particular. I haven't read Neonomicon, but that's Alan Moore's new work, and I hear it's very formally
It's very in your face.
It's very in your face in plot, but he's doing a lot of formal comic book techniques, like in the way he's framing to try and mess with your head a little bit. So panels within panels, but not literally, like the way the building sets up in the page is almost, or there's like a window within the panel that looks onto someone else. And so he sort of messes with you there. But I haven't read it, but I heard some Florida comic store pulled it off its shelves because they found it disagreeable. There's a rape scene, I've heard.
Yeah.
Alan Moore and rape scenes. I don't think I've read a single Alan Moore comic that doesn't have a rape scene.
No, he has some, I don't know, yeah.
That's a bit hokey. I'm sorry, I think that's almost inexcusable because it's so tired. As a technique to try and make you either feel sorry for the female protagonist or feel angry at the male antagonist. Because I think League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, for example, every volume has a rape, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, you could be right there.
Yeah. We could name them off if we wanted to. Should we?
No.
No, okay. But even in his most recent stuff. But just in general, I mean, horror's sort of in a weird phase right now in comics. There's this whole obsession with zombies and vampires, and I think it's almost running its course now.
A lot of, as usually is the case, the independent stuff. Like, I mean, 30 Days a Night, that was pretty awesome. There are some good horror stuff out there, and there'll be more to come, but you won't find it Marvel and DC necessarily.
Yeah, that's right. But, and there's certain types of tropes that pop up again and again, and whether it's zombies or vampires or, I don't know, werewolves was never huge, but say Frankenstein always pops up as a trope.
Yeah.
Jekyll and Hyde always pops up as a trope. And it's more interesting to see people trying something new, which, like, say, some of the books you've mentioned today and some of the ones I've mentioned. And, yeah.
The Walking Dead would be a huge one, which neither of us are that familiar with, but, yeah becoming a TV series
on
the
AMC TV
network. Yeah. But, that's all about zombies, but in a good way, from what I understand.
Yeah, I hear it's quite good.
Again, it's more about the people, and I think that's what any good horror story should be about. There has to be some kind of, you have to relate to somebody inside. There has to be some kind of human element. Even the weirdest Japanese ones you've mentioned, they still bring out some response because you can kind of identify with the humanity inside its pages.
Yeah, that weird spirals one I mentioned always follows this one girl, and everyone around her is going crazy. And that's what ties you to a story, not it's about zombies, so cool, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that seems to be a lot of what we're seeing these days. And I think we've avoided talking about those kind of books successfully. Yeah. We did not even mention Marvel's freaking obsession with zombies.
Well, that's died down now. They're obsessed with vampires. So after that, who knows what it'll be.
I think we've talked enough about horror.
I think so.
Yeah. It's drawing us to a close of our Halloween spectacular. I suggest you go to your local comic book store and grab some of those books we mentioned. But it's time to get on to...
We'll get recommendations.
Oh, for sure. And you'll find something you like of the genre. I'm not a huge fan of horror, to be honest, but the psychological stuff is what gets to me, for sure.
I've always been more of a sci-fi guy, but I seem to like more sci-fi films than comics for some reason, but I like superhero comics.
I need to lend you some sci-fi novels. I think there's something in there that you'd love.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice segue.
Absolutely.
Into our website of the week is goodshowsir.co.uk. That's goodshowsir.co.uk.
Yeah.
Our subtitle is Only the Worst Sci-Fi and Fantasy Book Covers.
Hmm.
And that pretty much tells you all you need to know. Every day, almost, people are encouraged to take photos of weird novel book covers from the sci-fi and fantasy genres and then submit them. So you can submit your own. And then basically the people kind of comment in a very snarky, humorous fashion. And then there's always lots of comments on these things. It's a very strange... Are you looking at it now?
I'm looking at it now. Some of them I think they're a bit harsh to make fun of. But other ones are like, that's terrible.
If you scroll down to where it says ratings on the right-hand column, you'll see they're all rated out of 10. The first one is called I Sing the Body Electric. And that's the winner on this stage. Are you there, Maladen?
Yep, so you vote for what is out of 10 being bad?
Yes, okay. I would imagine so. And this is a novel by Ray Bradbury, and it's called I Sing the Body Electric. And do you want to describe the cover?
Okay, are these called centaurs? Is that it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Those half man, wraparound cover. It's a Ray Bradbury story. It's a half, it's half men, half horse deals. And on each, he's sort of flexing his muscles. And on each arm, he's got two other men flexing their muscles. But do you know what that needed? Every iteration of the men on his arms flexing their muscles should have had men on their arms flexing their muscles.
Yes,
infinite fractal.
There's 28 comments on this cover alone. So, that pretty much tells you all you need to know. The rules for submitting your own worst cover that you might come across in a bookstore in your travels.
I've got some bad ones, trust me.
Yeah. There's three things. Number one, so much going on, it burns your eyes.
Yeah.
We want covers with elves, dragons, spaceships, and large busted women all on the same glorious cover.
Lovely.
Two, terrible art. Crazed monsters that are congenital disorders with no skeletal support, brushstrokes that display a hilariously misinformed understanding of anatomical proportions, blah, 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 different fonts, magical light orbs that lack even the most basic digital imaging techniques. Number three, epic things happening. Look for people doing crazy things such as holding a staff to a dragon's eye, firing a laser pistol with one hand whilst doing stunts on a hover bike with the other, that kind of stuff. So... sci-fi and fantasy seem to get the best and worst out of covers. That it looks like I mean,
some of these
the
aren't
most
fair.
One is a dance band and on the Titanic, and there's like a jet fighter, a couple of pterodactyls with masks, and some guy in a red jumpsuit and another guy playing the trombone.
Yeah.
None of this, some of these, just a lot of them are from the 70s and 80s, and then there's the worst ones from the 90s where people discovered Photoshop. Mm. And there's just like magical creatures playing musical instruments for no reason, and
women. My favourites have always, or my least favourites, I should say, have always been those fantasy covers which look like they've been done by some, I guess, art school student who specialises in watercolour pencils. And there's a great one for a Marion Zimmer Bradley story, and it looks, it's like a Renaissance fair. It's just so tacky. Some of these aren't fair. I love the psychedelic 70s one. There's a guy climbing out of an astronaut's helmet. So I think there's some awesome ones on here. But
There's Robert Heinlein's The Puppet Masters, a nude guy with a rifle and a little hat with a feather in it being chased by some
dogs
with no flesh on it. And yeah, I mean, there's like 30, you know, there's almost 40 pages of stuff here. So there's something for...
I'm bookmarking it, my friend.
They're not all hilarious, but there are some pretty funny ones. And if you're an art or design student, it's a good thing to avoid. And even just the titles, The White Sibyl, or, you know, The Wall Around a Star, Before They Were Giants, Myth, MYTE, Inc., In Action, Still, I Persist in Wondering, Unicorn Variations, and, you know, all manner of things.
Yeah, that's stupid.
Some of these I can't even explain. Looks like Salvador Dali's worst day.
How stupid and lame. Now, let's talk about Superman. No.
So that's goodshowsir.co.uk. If you want a good laugh.
Pretty cool site, yeah. I like it.
And if you have, you know, we all have cameras on our phones and that nowadays. So if you ever run across some mom and pop secondhand bookstore and you see an irresistible book cover, please take a picture of it for the world's delight and humour.
Absolutely. Okay, I think we're got to wrap up now. We've gone well over time.
That's a horror issue. So in the next coming weeks, we'll be talking about Texas and bounty hunters and deaths and resurrections.
Oh, greatest death scenes followed by greatest resurrection scenes, and that'll be a two-parter special. I think
it's like that's a little mini-series.
And we're going to get guests on more often because I think that worked really well.
Yes, thank you to Gianni from Collie Comics who joined us last week. And
Fashal.
If you want to email us, it's Chris with a K at extrasequential.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can check all our previous podcasts on Mixcloud or on iTunes or on extrasequential.com.
Music for the show is at purgeaudit.com. And that's it, is it?
That is it. You sound uncertain.
Oh, it's really hot and I can't wait to open up a window.
Wow.
We are recording on a sunny Saturday afternoon. I should go to the beach. Do you want to go to the beach? Let's go to the beach.
I'm not much of a beach man.
Neither am I. I think it's time to change. Throw away these comics. Go play some sport. Watch some cricket. We are in Australia after all. Even the thought of watching cricket.
It's not that interesting. I'd rather look at good shows. So.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, everyone.
We look forward to blathering on to your eardrums next week.
Or bathering on. This has been Maladdin and Chris, and you'll hear us next week.
You sure will. Thanks for listening, as always.